Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for this evening. We have with us Lauren Murray, and we're going to be talking about depleted uranium. Are you with us there?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
And it's good to have you with us. And I got the material you sent me by email. And so we'll have a good time this evening. And for our listeners out there, depleted uranium is a very real program. Now, the government says, oh, there's nothing to worry about. You know, it's depleted. That means there's no radioactivity. And we wouldn't use this if it's going to be harmful to the civilians or the military. And yet, of course, we have almost 200,000 Gulf War veterans who are ill. Whether it's 225,000, we don't know, but we do know the government says there's only 20,000 people with Gulf War illness. Of course, a few years ago they were saying there was no Gulf War illness, nobody was sick, nobody was exposed to sarin gas. Then they finally said 5,000 were exposed to sarin gas, 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000. The last figure they admitted, 130,000 Americans were exposed to sarin gas, and they knew it all along, and they simply lied. Now, the other thing is the same thing holds true with depleted uranium, and we'd planned to have Dr. Rocky with us tonight. He's a physicist. I don't know. Does he have a PhD? I know he's a physicist with the Army 20-some years, and he was assigned the job of determining how contaminated the military equipment was that had been hit with depleted uranium shells, and cleaning that up after the first Gulf War. And of course, when he came up with a report and told the truth about depleted uranium, why he was simply gotten out of the military, he's been harassed, he's been threatened, his house has been broken into, everything has been done to intimidate him. He's been ordered not to talk about the danger that he found when he was dealing with the depleted uranium, and the fact really that many members of his own contingent became very ill. These were the soldiers under his command when they were cleaning up the depleted uranium there as a result of the Gulf War. Well, he couldn't be with us tonight, but Lauren was kind enough to come on with us. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're concerned about depleted uranium and how you got into this battle along with him?
Well, I'm a scientist, and I'm actually a geoscientist, so I study the Earth and Earth processes, and of particular interest is atmospheric dusts and how they travel around the Earth and the planet, and they leave a record in the ice sheets in Greenland and in Antarctica. So we know quite a lot about the atmosphere from these annual layers, which are like tree rings, and the atmospheric tests and radiation, radioactive pollution, volcanic eruptions. There are many things that are recorded in the ice.
I know. Do you work at Los Alamos?
I worked at Livermore.
Livermore, okay.
From 1989 to 91, and I observed so much science fraud and graft and corruption, exactly what they're being investigated for now by Congress, the Government Accounting Office, the FBI, and actually the University of California really just acts like a slumlord. They get paid a lot to manage the labs, and they just have a hands-off management policy. They're really very disturbing places to work. I also worked at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab for 5 years. So I really didn't know anything at all about radiation when I worked in these labs. The only thing that I knew about it was that we used it to date rocks, and we could tell the age of the Earth, and from meteorites we got information from the radioactive isotopes in them. But I really didn't know anything about radiation, and certainly not about depleted uranium, until about 3 or 4 years ago. And I was invited to speak in Japan at the 2000 World Conference Against Atomic and Hydrogen Bombs in August of 2000. And I met Akira Toshiro then, who he is a Hiroshima journalist who writes a lot about survivors around the world. They're called hibakusha in Japanese, survivors of radiation exposure. And I was really shocked in the Peace Museum in Hiroshima and then in Nagasaki to learn that we had radiation survivors in the United States, and that they were exposed from atmospheric tests at the Nevada test site.
Intentionally exposing our people without even their knowledge or consent. And of course, there have been so many of these experiments that have gone on. Over 500,000 Americans have been experimented on without their knowledge by these wicked, wicked people at the upper echelons of government who are answerable to no one. Not to Congress, not to our duly elected representatives, not even to God, it would appear.
You're absolutely right. And as I began working and learning sort of as a scientist out of the box, I became an independent scientist serving the public and sort of a citizen scientist, I guess you could call me. It was because I realized how devastated American Indians have been by the nuclear project. And by that, I mean the development of nuclear weapons under the Manhattan Project, and then the building of a nuclear weapons arsenal, and that it's very closely, intimately linked to nuclear power, which was the only way they could get the plutonium from the spent fuel to build a nuclear weapons program. And, you know, the government and the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy like to talk about the dollars and the budget and the cost of this and the impact on their budget and so forth. But what people don't realize is that it has had a tremendous impact and cost in terms of public health globally. And 1.3 billion people have been killed, diseased, maimed.
No, that's a pretty high figure. Tell me, how were they diseased and maimed? Can you document that?
Well, basically, in November, the United States government admitted that every single person in the United States who lived here during atmospheric testing, especially the last 4 years from 1959 to 63, was exposed to radiation.
No, but of course we're exposed to radiation, you know, simply when we get in a plane, because there's radiation, much more radiation there than there is on the ground level. So what level of radiation are we talking about?
Well,
what factor does hormesis play? Hormesis being the fact that very low radiation can actually be beneficial.
I work with independent scientists all over the world. And these scientists have actually been conducting epidemiological studies on exposed populations. And what we're learning from Chernobyl, from the nuclear plant workers, such as at Sellafield in England, from people living along the Irish Sea coast and the Welsh coast, who have leukemia clusters now, from very, very low levels of radiation, which are dumped from Sellafield into the Irish Sea, 60 million gallons a day. And
What are they dumping out? Is it coming from a nuclear plant or what?
Sellafield is a nuclear reprocessing plant.
Oh, it's a nuclear reprocessing. Okay, so they're reprocessing the fuel is what you're saying.
That's right.
All right, so that's different than a nuclear plant completely.
It's a reprocessing plant, and it's dumping the fragmented, well, in the fission process, uranium-235 makes up nuclear power plant fuel, and it fissions just as it does in an atomic bomb when it explodes, and that just means that the uranium atoms are bombarded with neutrons. It puts extra energy into the nucleus, and they fragment or explode in
well,
sort of.
Well, they don't really explode. They don't. They actually just create tremendous heat. I mean,
no, they fragment. The uranium fragments into over 230 other radioactive isotopes.
But I mean, there doesn't actually. There's no explosion.
No, it's slowly. It's a controlled fission.
Okay. Well, now where does all this fit into depleted uranium? Because what happens is when they manufacture, when they mine uranium, then they want to get the plutonium out of it, at least uranium-235, isn't it? And so they take that all out, and then they leave you with, is it 238 that's left over?
Yeah, 238, and there's a little, well, it's like 99.97% uranium-238 is left over. The half-life is 4.5 billion years.
All right.
And there's a little bit, 0.2% U-235 left, because they only remove 0.5% of U-235 from the mass. And then there's a tiny bit of U-234.
All right, so basically this is a very, very, very heavy metal, and since it is radioactive, the government didn't know what to do with it, so they came up with a wonderful idea. They were going to make it into artillery shells, into bombs, and cruise missile shells, so it could be used in the military and even use it on 50 caliber machine gun bullets, because it's very, very hard. It'll go through anything. It'll go right through an enemy tank. And, of course, when it goes in, why it really burns, and it creates a uranium oxide dust, doesn't it?
That's right.
Okay.
And that dust is extremely fine, super fine particles. They're a tenth of a micron in diameter. That's the average size. But even down to 10 angstroms, they're smaller than bacteria or viruses. And they behave like a radioactive gas. So that when you are in the area or downwind or even in the region, you cannot avoid being exposed. You breathe it. It's invisible. You can't taste it. You don't know it's there. But it reaches the blood-lung barrier, and the white blood cells see those tiny specks, which the blood cells are 10 microns or larger. And they engulf these tiny particles and take them all over the body, every part of the body, the bones, the brain. They cross the placental barrier into the fetus. We've measured DU in 71 residents of Basra who died after the Gulf War. The DU levels were the same no matter where we measured them in the body. So
now, then how much was the level of the depleted uranium? It's really not depleted uranium. It's really uranium-238 that is most of it, and it's actually been put into a dust. Now, you can handle the shells. You're not going to get a problem from that. But, of course, if you start breathing this dust, you're going to get it right into your body. Would that be a fair statement?
It's impossible to avoid breathing it once it burns.
Right.
And it's distributed like fairy dust all over in your body, and each of these tiny particles has millions and millions of atoms, even though they're so tiny. And these emit radiation. Alpha particles are the most damaging biologically.
Now, of course, this is different than the 235 and the other types of that. Can you actually pick this up with a Geiger counter, or do you have to have a special equipment to pick it up?
You can detect the gamma rays that are also emitted, but you need a very special instrument with sort of a pancake head on it. That actually Doug Rocky developed that, and you can measure the alpha radiation, but it has a very, very short path. It only travels one or two cells, so so it's very hard to detect with an instrument unless it's specially designed.
Well, now, what happened to the men who were in Doug Rocky's unit? Doug was a major in the military. He was a physicist, and, of course, he was assigned to clean up the areas of depleted uranium, certainly in our own tanks. There were really probably well over 1,000, maybe several thousand Iraqi tanks that were just wiped out with this, and apparently some of our soldiers went over and, gee, there's Iraqi tanks. Let's go inside, get some souvenirs. And what happened? Do you know, have they really tracked how many those young men who got into the Iraqi tanks, came down with serious illness because of the exposure to the depleted uranium dust?
Well, let me just explain that nothing was known about depleted uranium. Those people who were sent over in Gulf War I had never heard of it, because Gulf War I is the first time depleted uranium was really used on the battlefield as a military weapon. And the military certainly did not inform the soldiers who were shipped over there to that war. It also, the use of DU broke a 46-year taboo against using radiation on the battlefield as a radiological weapon. And in my letter to Congressman McDermott, which is on the Internet, I have attached a declassified memo dated October 30th, 1943, to General Leslie Groves, who was head of the Manhattan Project. And in that detailed report from the three top physicists who were working on the Manhattan Project, Dr. Urey, Dr. Compton, and Dr. Conant, they outlined exactly what is a blueprint for depleted uranium. They said radioactive materials should be ground very finely into 1/10 micron particles and dispersed on the battlefield from the air or on the ground, and that they would go through all gas masks. It would be impossible to develop protective clothing. The dust is so fine it goes through any protective clothing. They knew that it would contaminate the environment, denying access to either enemy or friendly fire without being exposed.
But Lauren, were they talking about depleted uranium, or were they talking about some other type of uranium?
They were talking about radioactive materials.
Okay, fine. This wasn't necessarily the depleted uranium. This was
any radioactive
material,
yes.
Right?
Right. And the half-life, the length of the half-life, makes the radioactive material hotter. If it's a short half-life, it's much hotter. And if it's a long half-life, it's less radioactive, but it just means that the damage will happen more slowly. It's still radioactive. And the really tragic thing about uranium-238 is that it decays from uranium-238 in 4 steps to other much more radioactive isotopes such as radon, polonium, many, many other radioactive isotopes. So any place that we have used it will become more and more radioactive over time.
But of course, we're talking about half-life of 4.5 billion years. So how rapidly, what effect is this really having on the soldiers? Do we have any solid information, as to what happened to the soldiers who were involved in cleaning up the depleted uranium or came in contact? Right.
Yeah. What happened is, first of all, 450,000 Gulf War I soldiers were exposed. 230,000, some 230,000 are eligible for disability benefits. Doug Rocky and his team were not only exposed in Iraq cleaning up the mess.
We're going to have to hold that right there. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Lauren Murray, and we're going to be talking about depleted uranium. Murray, and we're talking about depleted uranium. Do you want to go ahead there?
Sure. Yes, the people now are living in unsanitary conditions. It's hot there. The disease and epidemics will really damage their health. Their immune systems are damaged also by the radiation exposure. and slowly the Iraqi people are going to die. There's death by homicide. There's death by genocide. This is omnicide. This is killing the planet. This is killing all living things in that area, and it will make it impossible for anything to live there.
Well, now, what's happened to the areas of Kuwait where the battles were fought? What's happened to the people of Kuwait now? Because this is 12 years later since the war. Do we have any knowledge about the impact of the depleted uranium in Kuwait during the first Gulf War?
I have two pieces of information. I found a scientific report. They are monitoring the depleted uranium levels in the air all over Kuwait.
Now, who's monitoring it?
This is scientists who are, they're working for the World Health Organization.
Okay.
or other agencies.
Is the World Health Organization aware of the problem?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, then why aren't they saying anything?
It's a privately owned corporation.
The World Health Organization
Yes.
is a privately owned corporation?
Yes.
Well, if they're a privately owned corporation, why don't they speak out? Or is it the people who own the corporation are controlling what's said?
Exactly. It's controlled.
All right, fine. Now, what about the people there, though? I've talked to my friend, Dr. Garth Nicholson. He said about 20% of the population of Kuwait has a syndrome similar to the Gulf War illness. Have you heard any figures one way or the other? Would you confirm that? I haven't
heard any figures, but as I go around talking to different community groups, the Muslim women have come up and said to me, our families in Kuwait are suffering. The children are born now, and they're getting leukemia, and they're getting childhood diabetes. And we never had that before. This is after the Gulf War I. And I said that from our studies around nuclear power plants, we know that children's diabetes is a radiation-related disease, as well as leukemia. So that is actually the only information I have personally.
All right, fine. So we're just going to take time. This doesn't happen overnight. In fact, a lot of our men who came back from the Gulf War initially weren't so ill. And then as time has gone by, more and more and more of them have reported the symptoms of Gulf War illness. Is that right?
That's right. And you have to realize that as the uranium decays, it slowly impacts the body more and more, and it has a cumulative effect. Additionally, they were exposed to chemicals, biological agents. They had as many as 8 vaccines at one time, which damaged the immune system or perhaps even overwhelmed it. And these other agents act synergistically with radiation. So I kind of say 1 + 1 = 2. Radiation and chemicals and bioagents acting together. We don't even know what the effect is because research has not been done on it, but we know it's much greater than any of them alone.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now you're trying to get this information out. The government keeps insisting there's nothing to worry about, but you have all of these government reports that actually express the government's concern and the concern of the government investigators.
That's right, and they were done by reputable scientists, and some of the reports were conducted at the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab. Some were conducted at the Battelle Northwest Labs up in Washington State. They do military investigations. Some were done at the Army laboratories, and some at the Air Force laboratories, and it's irrefutable. I always use their own reports on them. They laid it all out in the reports.
Well, now, one of the things that we have heard that apparently over in Bosnia, there were a lot of, English soldiers there. They were Bosnia or Kosovo, I can't remember which.
They were NATO. NATO.
Right. And, of course, they were concerned about the incidence of leukemia and the soldiers coming home, and then the government came up with a report and said, oh, well, yes, you may have 15 soldiers with leukemia, but we took, 15 young men, the same age group, out of the general population. That's about what we'd expect as well, so that doesn't mean anything. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Another cover-up.
Were they lying?
They were lying.
All right.
Yes,
fine.
But the difference is that in the Gulf War, once the soldiers came home, if they had babies that were deformed, they could never leave the military. So the military has been able to really suppress and cover up and hide this national disaster.
Now, in other words, basically they couldn't leave the military because they couldn't get any health insurance for the children. Is
they
that what
could get no health coverage for the children, nor for themselves. So, but once the NATO forces, these were blonde and blue-eyed and white soldiers in Europe who went to the Balkans, and when they began getting sick and dying, it was their parents in Portugal, in Italy, in other countries where the United States did not have so much control, who began speaking out. And that was really when the curtain started getting pulled on the cover-up.
Well, I think that, you know, it's important what you and what Doug Rocky are doing to get this information out across America. Is there any book that's ever been written on this that really is all-inclusive?
Oh, there are two that I'd like to recommend.
All right.
One is Discounted Casualties, the Human Cost of Depleted Uranium.
Discounted Casualties, all right, The Human Cost of Depleted Uranium.
And it's you can read it online on the Internet. The entire book is translated into English from Japanese. And just do a Google search on that name. The author is Akira Toshiro.
Why don't we just count it, Discounted Casualties?
Yeah. And then the other book is also very excellent, and that is called Medal of Dishonor, How the Pentagon Irradiates Its Own Soldiers. And that is by the International Action Center. That's the organization Ramsey Clark started. And you can order it from the International Action Center website.
All right, fine. So
they're both excellent.
Do they have a lot of good documentation in them?
Yes, they do.
All right, fine. Now, what about your all this documentation you've accumulated? Is that available anyplace?
Well, the best thing is to read my letter to Congressman McDermott, because I have the scientific charts and...
How expensive is your letter?
It's free. You can read it on the Internet.
All right.
And if you go to the website, www.mindfully.org, and you click on Nukes, and then you find Letter to Congressman McDermott, you can read a very complete letter with 20 references. They're all on the website, and 10 attachments, including the declassified memo to General Groves.
All right, fine. And what is that memo to General Groves? Now, General Groves was the one in charge of the Manhattan Project, wasn't he?
That's right. And
but that's going back to 1943, 1942, somewhere in there.
That's right. And they knew even then the dangers of finely, very finely ground or dust radioactive materials. And it's just it's a blueprint for depleted uranium. They knew that before they dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Basically, they knew exactly what depleted uranium would do on the battlefield before they even dropped the nuclear weapons.
But, of course, there's a difference between the type of radiation in the nuclear weapons and depleted uranium.
That's right. The fallout from nuclear weapons, a lot of the exposure is external gamma rays, although when it gets into the environment and into dairy products and drinking water, then you become internally exposed. But depleted uranium is different. It's it's an altered natural isotope of uranium after it burns on the battlefield, and of course, after U-235 is removed from it. And this kind of an exposure, it's a new kind of exposure. So this will be a new population study or epidemiological study on a new kind of radiation exposure. However, an alpha particle is an alpha particle is an alpha particle. And whether it comes out of nuclear bombs or depleted uranium or a nuclear power plant, an alpha particle is the most damaging exposure that the biological system can has a devastating impact on biological systems.
All right, fine. And of course, but you say it only travels a very, very short distance.
And that's why it's so dangerous. The molecules that hold life together in a cell are bound by 10 electron volts. An alpha particle dumps 5 million electron volts of energy into one or two cells. So basically, it's a bullet that tears through the cells, ripping the membranes and damaging the internal structure of the cell and the DNA. But all of that energy, it's like a hot coal, putting a hot coal in the cell, and all that energy has to dissipate just like the heat in a coal would. And that energy does 80% of the damage from radiation. So it's not just the physical tearing of that nuclear bullet, but it's the energy it releases.
All right. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're out there and you have a question or comment for our special guest this evening, Lauren Murray, and we're talking about depleted uranium. And give that website again where people can get that letter you sent to Congressman McDermott.
Yes, it's www.mindfully.org. Click on nukes and then click on letter to Congressman McDermott.
All right, fine. And of course, then you'll get all the other things that you have now. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Now, of course, what response did you get from the congressman after you wrote to him?
Oh, I went to Seattle and I spent 4 hours in his office with one of his staff aides who is sort of collecting all the information about depleted uranium. And they were extremely receptive. Congressman McDermott has introduced a bill in Congress, H.R. 1483. It's called the Depleted Uranium Study Bill, and it requires research and investigations on the health and other effects from depleted uranium weaponry. And we need the public to put pressure on their members of Congress, their representatives in Congress, to support this bill.
All right, fine. Well, of course, the thing is that everything in the media tells us that there's nothing to worry about. And that's, of course, why we really should worry. And I noticed you had actually sent a note here, I guess, to Congressman McDermott or somebody else, talking about the hepatitis B study and all the homosexuals that took the hepatitis B vaccine. And it wasn't 100% of them got AIDS, but certainly a significant number of them did get AIDS, far more than the general population, which would suggest very, very strongly that the virus, the infection, the epidemic was begun in that hepatitis B vaccine study given the homosexuals both in New York and San Francisco.
That's right, and what I'm really concerned about now is that Rumsfeld is dumping billions of dollars into constructing bioweapons level 4 labs at private universities and the national labs. Now, why are they building all of these bioweapons level 4 labs? It's to develop biological agents which they are planning to use in warfare.
Well, I think that either that or to depopulate the planet. In fact,
depopulate the planet.
If you go to the study that comes off of his website, at least he's a part of it. It's called the newamericancentury.org, and any of our listeners can go there and actually pull down the report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. That's at newamericancentury.org. And there, if you want the exact page, I can get it for you. I don't have it with me, but it will be in my either this month's or next month's newsletter, where they actually talk about how wonderful it is. We're going to have all these new biological weapons. In fact, they will be able to target specific genotypes, and they can be used for political purposes. What they're really talking about is racial extermination. Now, those are their words, not mine, that these weapons, these biological weapons, which will be developed, will be able to target specific genotypes. They have already done this in the past, and of course, I think they're going to get much more efficient weapons that they will be able to use in the future. Wouldn't you feel just a little uneasy knowing that Donald Rumsfeld, who got aspartame legalized, put into our soft drinks, knowing full well that it produced brain tumors, certainly of convulsions, all sorts of cancers throughout the body, that was a deadly poison put into our drinks as aspartame. Wouldn't you be concerned that he is going to be building all these new biological weapons? Because there are laws against biological weapons. Supposedly, we said we would never make or use biological weapons. And yet, of course, why are we opening all these new labs? I didn't know that. Lauren, how did you find that out?
Well, I'm on the Environmental Commission in the city of Berkeley, and the Lawrence Berkeley Lab representatives came to talk to us about a molecular foundry or nanotechnology lab they want to construct at LBNL, and this will be for military applications. And we learned that a bioweapons level 4 lab was planned at UC Davis. This is in a densely populated area right next to the capital of the state of California. The water systems around that area are used for the whole northern part of the state. And it's a very unsuitable location to have such a risky laboratory.
Now, to explain to our listeners what a level 4 is, because they probably don't know what the difference between a 4 and 5.
Well, I didn't know either, but I sure found out. And what I learned is that bioweapons level 4 lab, which is the highest level of danger that, or the most lethal organisms are handled in a level 4 lab, and even one bacteria or one single virus can cause death. There is also a bioweapons level 5 lab, which is not allowed in the continental U.S., but the U.S. government has constructed one at Plum Island off of Long Island, and there's only one other in the world. It's the World Health Organization bioweapons level 5 lab in Trieste. So there are only two in the world, and they have horrible ventilation problems. They don't have backup generators. When they have problems there, they just use duct tape around the doors to seal off the rooms. And we believe that Lyme's disease escaped from the Plum Island bioweapons level 5 lab.
What about West Nile virus? Because certainly, what's West Nile virus doing all over the United States today? That, you know, that was over in the West Nile area. Somehow it got all across America into our birds, and of course is certainly going to be coming back again as soon as we get in the mosquito season.
That's right, and what is very suspicious is the pattern of distribution or where it turned up and when. And it does not look like a natural vector spreading of disease. So that's also very suspicious.
All right. Well, I would suggest to our listeners that this is the ultimate in genocidal weapons. So why are we working with them? Oh, well, we've got to be ahead of our enemies. But who are our enemies? Why, the wicked Osama bin Laden. And we've got to have these weapons so we can counter Osama bin Laden, or is it the Russians, or is it the Chinese, or who's the enemy this week or next week? Well, I think that it's so important that people understand that there really are people who would like to kill off most of the people in the world. And if you really doubt that, why, you'll certainly want to get our April newsletter once I get it finished. It has some quotations in there that are truly chilling. And yet, there are people out there in the world today who are evil.
And I'd like to mention that even genetically modified plants and food are being designed also for genocidal purposes. They are testing a spermicidal corn in Mexico right now.
Now, by spermicidal, you mean that will decrease male fertility.
That's right.
I don't know why they need that. They've got water fluoridation. They've got aspartame.
Yeah.
Because both of those are, of course, designed to attack reproduction. They know exactly what they're doing. If our listeners out there want to verify anything we're saying, why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the scientific studies that show that fluoride effect has a very definite effect on fertility rates. Of course, we have the study by Frenny, who was employed by the National Institute of Health, or U.S. Public Health Service, to study, and they found in parallel areas, one with fluoridated water, the other without fluoridated water, the higher the fluoride level in the drinking water, the lower the fertility, the lower the fluoride, the higher the fertility, and of course, aspartame has a profound impact on reproduction as well. So here's two things they're doing, but a genetically modified corn, gee, they could get that into everything, couldn't they?
That's right, or they can feed it to particular targeted populations. And fertility in men is at a nationwide low now. I don't know how many people are aware of that, but from studying radiation and the public health effects, we're monitoring fertility in men also. This is all just really alarming, and the public needs to be informed. Also, fluorine, the fluoridation idea, came out of the fluorine that is a byproduct or part of the waste stream from the nuclear weapons project. And uranium hexafluoride is a gas, which is how they separate U-235 out of the other natural isotopes. So they had all this depleted uranium left over and the fluorine. They decided to put it in our water.
I think it's the most incredible thing. If any of our listeners out there haven't need more information, we have a wonderful 4-tape set on fluoridation. We carry a wonderful book called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Dr. Russell Blaylock. You need to have this information because, ladies and gentlemen, there is an organized effort to mandate water fluoridation in every community across America. And we're talking about, they know that it's going to affect the brain. We know it's going to affect the bones. We know it's going to affect the endocrine system. We know it's going to present as carcinogenic. And that's why they're putting it in the water supply. These people are not dumb. They are diabolical. I want to thank you so much for filling in this evening for Doug. Lauren, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I want that report you mentioned, the Rockefeller report.
Well, you give me a call. You have my number.
Give me
a call. We'll get that to you, and we'll get you anything you want. Because go to our website, radioliberty.com, and we'll send you gratis we charge other people, but for you, you get a free copy of the report.
Oh, well, don't worry. I'll use it and tell everyone about
it.
But I want to thank you for what you were doing, for your website, for your effort to inform the public. We are very, very fortunate to have people like you who are willing to speak out, and you're very courageous. And I'm really very pleased to have been invited this evening to be on your show. Thank you very much.
Well, God bless you, and we probably will be getting you on again because you're very articulate. Thank you so much, Lauren.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Lauren Murray, and I hope you enjoyed the program. And, I think this is a very, very important subject, and I suggest to you that you get the information and help us to get it out across America. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you out there in the listening audience to help us do what we do 5 hours every day. And then, of course, we have our program on the weekend so that our message is getting out to about 55 different outlets across America every week now. I wish they were every day, but some of them are just half an hour. But, of course, you can get a lot of information out in half an hour, and hopefully then the people are getting onto our website and listening on the Internet radio. You can listen to us 5 hours a day at radioliberty.com, either directly there or linking to our other networks where we're heard. Because you won't get anything done, but you will certainly be able to get the information and get it to others. encourage others to go to our website, radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we certainly ask you to give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to finance what we do. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you would be interested in helping us or making a pledge, I would love to get this program on shortwave as well. The program is excellent. It's heard in the Great Northwest, but we need to get it heard all across America. We have an opportunity to get it onto shortwave. It's just a matter of having the funding to do it. And if you'd like to make a pledge to help us, we can get great, great rates, because I will tell you, most of the major ministries are going off shortwave. They're all having difficulty. We're having difficulty as well, but we really need to expand to reach as many people as we can in the time that God gives us. So if you'd like to either join the Radio Liberty family or make a pledge to help us get the evening program onto shortwave, and if you want to make a pledge for 6 months, why, it really is incredibly economical, at least for the first 6 months, and by then hopefully it will begin to take care of itself. If you'd like to help us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because I'm firmly convinced that if the American people don't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on America. And, of course, we ask you certainly to remember our boys overseas. And remember, they're in as much danger now as they ever were. Because, of course, with the depleted uranium, that is every place they're going to be, that dust, of course, is getting into their lungs. And they don't understand that. They're not being told the truth. But, of course, you have to understand what Henry Kissinger said. And he's quoted in the book, The Final Days, page 194, Woodward and Bernstein's book, saying our military men are simply stupid, dumb animals to be used for political purposes. Stupid, dumb animals to be used for political purposes. That's Henry Kissinger. And I think he reflects the elite who rule the world. Pray for those boys. And please pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, at the same, I guess Monday now, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us one of my favorite guests, our good friend, Len Horwitz. Hi, how are you doing, Len?
Brother Stan, very, very blessed, brother. How's it going with you?
I'm doing fine. And Dr. Horwitz is a dentist. He has his master's in public health. And, of course, he was a very successful dentist, doing fine. He was on the staff back at the... You went to Harvard, didn't you?
I was on the faculty at Harvard,
right,
and Tufts University. I taught medical and dental histology. You remember that course, Dan?
Oh, sure, right. And, of course, he was doing quite well until he was hired by a company to go down and investigate the case of the woman, a young lady, Kimberly Pegalis, in Florida, who acquired the HIV disease, supposedly from her dentist, by casual contact. And of course, he, as he looked into this more and more, he suddenly realized that the government was lying once again. And it wasn't that this was a case of casual contact to six people or six of the patients of the doctor. He had intentionally infected those people because he believed the government had created the HIV virus and he was dying of it. And this was his way of striking back at society and trying to draw attention to what he conceived of was a genocidal policy of the government. And, well, of course, that then got Len started on an odyssey, and it really hasn't stopped yet, has it?
Well, I'll tell you, that was a great summary, and that's correct. It hasn't stopped yet. I kind of look at my life as a roller coaster ride through the twilight zone.
Well, of course, the first book was Emerging Virus. The first book was the story of what happened in Florida, and of course, the next book was Emerging Viruses. And if you haven't read it, you need to. In fact, I had my copy out today. I keep it there very close because it's got wonderful information. We have his book, Death in the Air. We carry that, and Len has written so many books and has so much excellent material, but tonight we're certainly going to talk about the SARS epidemic as it's coming down the line. And, of course, the one question everybody has is, see, where did this come from? Oh, well, it came out of China because they got so many pigs and ducks over there, and pigs and ducks and hogs, and so that explains where it came from. Is they must think the American people are awful dumb.
Unfortunately, they are. I heard your message prior, and I'll tell you what, I think we better start praying. We better start giving all of our hearts over to the Creator because we're in sad shape. You know, I look at the SARS thing, Stan, instead of severe acute respiratory syndrome, that acronym I've given the name Sickening and Repulsive Scam.
Okay, fine. Well, I think that's very insightful. And, of course, you know, what I'm doing all the talking. They really want to hear you. So what's your take on this whole thing? You know, of course, one of the things that is so incredible is, I mean, you know, we know, for instance, the communists killed about 44 million people in 1960, 61, 62. Not a word about it in the media. I mean, what have we got, the 30,000 people die every year of influenza here in the United States. You know, that doesn't get sort of a little blip on the, you know, in the media. And suddenly the attention of the whole world is focused on the SARS epidemic. And I counted the Wall Street Journal one day. They had five different articles on SARS. In fact, I'm so tired of seeing the little round oriental faces with a funny-looking face mask on them. We see this every place we look. And they're playing games with our minds. Certainly there's a problem there, but I haven't quite figured out what this is all about. But it really isn't about the fact that 500 people or so have died of this disease. There's something else they're up to.
Well, that's exactly my diagnosis, too, Doc. The fact of the matter is we put up a website almost a month ago now called SARSscam.com, www.SARSscam.com, wherein I did my analysis on it. And looking at the book Death in the Air, Globalism, Terrorism, and Toxic Warfare, where we laid out the globalist agenda for public health and the new infectious diseases, the new white-collar bioterrorism, not the blue-collar type, not the Muslim type, but those pharmaceutical industrialist-linked type of devil doers that create frights and use fear to manipulate the populations into various political as well as even medical policies. And so that's what I see is taking place. And I think you're absolutely on target with your analysis that there's something more going on here that besides an infectious agent. And we can talk a lot about that infectious agent. And I likewise believe that it's a laboratory creation. and that it's a cofactor in this thing that's called SARS. Just like the HIV-AIDS virus doesn't cause AIDS, it's a combination of mycoplasma. But the same thing with coronavirus, apparently. There's other agents that are co-infecting the immune-compromised individuals. So from what we're reading in the media, and as you said, the first thing that caught my attention was on the first day, and I was in Toronto, Brother Stan, when this whole thing happened, I happened to be there, and the first day they were already touting ribavirin and steroids for patients as a management approach to SARS, and the headlines were extraordinary. There were just two patients who had gotten SARS or had, died from SARS that first, about the 12th or so of March, and I was in Toronto. And the headlines and the newspapers frightened virtually the entire population of Toronto so severely that a week later, about a third of the population was staying away from the malls, staying off the city streets. It was beginning to stun the businesses. And so I observed that, and you know, my background, if I have any expertise at all, it's in my Harvard Master's in Public Health degree. It's in health education, health promotion, media, persuasion, technologies, research and development for health education. And I look at the way that the media very critically spins the half-truths and the truths that they tell, and ultimately its effect and designated effect, targeted effect on the population at large. That's my area of expertise. And what I saw them doing, which basically had me initiate, I felt in my heart compelled. I gave $1,000 to an attorney group that was working there in Toronto to try to have them file a cease and desist against the media, because as somebody who's very well versed in phobias and phobia induction through media persuasion, that I noticed that there were going to be more people dying of the fright than from the virus. And nobody's being a voice for those poor people. Those are the people, and you've got to understand, and I know you do, but your listeners might want to understand, that there is approximately 8 to 12% of the American population, conservatively, that are psychologically or pharmacologically predisposed to developing, beyond neuroses, to phobias, which ultimately is a real sickness, causing them avoidance behaviors. And you have people at high risk for various illnesses literally not going out. They're not going shopping. They're not getting their groceries. They're not going to the doctor's offices. So what is it that the media is doing? It is outrageous. And it's a violation of the public's faith as well as public health. And what I also noticed as an expert in the field of behavioral science and public health, I noticed that, and this was a complete tip-off to what you were saying being true, that it's a political agenda. It has nothing to do with public health whatsoever. And here's the tip. The entire field of risk communication, that is a science in behavioral science and in public health, whereby we all are trained in public health and education and health promotion to observe the rules in what is called risk communication, so that we as healthcare professionals, we as public health officials, can relay the facts in a way that people can appreciate the true risk, not have it be blown out of proportion. And there's ways of communicating. Now, for example, let's look at the numbers that they continue to relay and even are now, they're even worsening. They said that there was a mortality, a death rate, of between 5 and 6%. That was a lie. The truth of the matter is, here's the other way to communicate it, that well over 96% of the people who got infected, who were followed by the healthcare system, had their God-given gift, the immune system, kicked in, and they overcame the infections naturally because of their intact immune system. Instead, what they focused on was the death, fear, over and over again, and it's a complete distortion, because when you look simply at those numbers, the epidemiology of those mortality rates, you notice that they don't include the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who got this illness and then went on, again, to develop natural immunity and didn't die, didn't even become seriously ill. My wife is among them. I was among them. And so the bottom line is that every aspect of the way that this alleged outbreak, and I really think of it in the political sense, and we should get into this, why it came out in China, why it's China, why there's the focus on China currently. The bottom line is that it's a political agenda that literally misses all the earmarks of a responsible public health campaign.
Well, you know, I think it's really very interesting. They're saying that this is going to cut 2% of the growth in China's gross national product from 9.5% to 7.5%, at least during this quarter. And, you know, the people of China must be just frightened to death because they're getting the same propaganda barrage we are. And yet, of course, you know, there certainly I think the major impact has been on the healthcare providers and the hospitals. And, of course, it would appear to be a fairly readily spread organism. And yet, of course, as you point out, I mean, this is minuscule number of people have died, and they seem to have it fairly well controlled now in Singapore and in Toronto, and hopefully this same thing will happen with Hong Kong, and it's only a matter of time before they get this under control in China. And so really what they're doing is creating panic, and you know, apparently this has just had a tremendous impact on Hong Kong. People, as you pointed out in Toronto, they're not going to the shopping malls. They weren't going to the shopping malls. They weren't going to the restaurants. This is going to totally disrupt the economy there. And I think I almost had a feeling that this was a trial run for something else, because this disease on its own did not deserve the amount of propaganda and hysteria that was being created. You do not get 5 articles in the Wall Street Journal on one day, and actually it's been day after day after day, very often 2, 3, 4, 5 articles, you know, unless it is being used for a purpose. You're absolutely right, Lynn.
Yeah, and then, you know, when you consider the politics of the age, you look at, first of all, everybody's talking about the big one, the big one. Well, I don't believe that this is the big one, but I believe it's laying the precedent, not only in the public's mind, but also legislatively. You had Bush pass that legislation, putting the coronavirus on the same list as Ebola, which is a farce, and that ultimately mandating quarantining. So all of that was pushed forward by the SARS issue. You had, and by the way, we know, you know, I know your good listeners have known about the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, whereby the same agenda, the same political agenda, was already being promoted for well over a year and a half prior to this event.
Oh, and not only it was even being pushed prior to 9/11. That was the amazing thing. They already had this special legislation drawn up. I think it was drawn up at Johns Hopkins, but anyway, it was funded by the CDC at least a year before the September 11th attack, and yet they used September 11th to get the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, introduced in every state in the union, and that will require mandatory vaccination or quarantine, in case of a national public health emergency. What are they planning? Because obviously they know what's going to happen.
Right. And again, when you look at, you know, you referred earlier to my national bestseller, which is Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola. I was talking about in there, and we published that in 1996, how the Rockefeller's International Infectious Disease Surveillance Outposts were going to be paving the way for the New World Order agenda in biomedicine. And the World Health Organization, notice that this SARS agent, this is the first time you had the World Health Organization issuing these major global alerts. For example, don't travel to Toronto. You remember what happened when they announced that? The poor people, the politicians in Toronto were flabbergasted. They just could not believe the World Health Organization did this. And so suddenly now you're beginning to see this in the health field fitting in with the globalist agenda. All the directions in terms of healthcare directed from the World Health Organization, largely directed again by the Rockefeller cartel. Rockefeller petrochemical pharmaceutical cartel, and of course if you dig, as I know you have, you're always going to link the banksters of Germany and the royal family of England to the Rockefeller cartel. So the bottom line is that the New World Order, the globalist agenda, is being affected by fright primarily, driving populations into literally sickened states, mentally, emotionally and even physically. And where this fits in, where the SARS agent and all these other infectious diseases that we're now looking at on the horizon, with the biotechnologies that they've been doing, the genetic engineering in the laboratories, the cross-species transmissions and manipulations that are taking place in the laboratory, particularly heavy in the vaccination arena, that you have more and more of these infectious agents. And in fact, the words emerging viruses came from the National Cancer Institute's director of diagnostics for this whole realm of the new infectious agents that were going to be evolving from the laboratories, not by nature, but in labs, pharmaceutical-directed labs. And his name was Cy Coulter from Southwestern monkey colonies. And he held the contract. And ultimately, this coronavirus has all of the earmarks of an emerging virus that did not come from nature. It did not come from people in China living close to birds or bovines. Ultimately, it is laboratory, because when you begin to look at the coronavirus manipulations heavily done over the last 10 years, particularly, specifically in these cross-species transmission areas, you begin to realize, holy smoke. And then when you see the laboratories that were actually doing it, and this was the fine work of Patty Doyle and Robert Lee, they dug up the fact that one of the premier labs that were doing the coronavirus research had intimate connections to the Rockefeller cartel, the Rockefeller University Labs, and Rockefeller Foundation funding. And ultimately, what we're looking at is the same replay of what the West Nile virus scam was about that we wrote about in the book Death in the Air.
Okay, we've got Bruce calling in from Los Angeles right now. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Doing fine.
Well, I met this gentleman, Leonard Horowitz, at the Chapel Hill Library in 1995, right about the time of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I was doing research
on Chapel Hill in 1995.
Yeah, in the library, you were doing your research, and I was doing research on George de Bournchild.
That was the day that I found the special virus cancer.
Well,
program.
You see, Bruce is a personal friend of mine, and one of my patients while I was practicing, and since I left practice, a personal friend. So he's done the fundamental work on Bruce. On George de Bournchild.
Leonard knows about George de Bournchild,
Okay, but anyway, it's a small world. When Bruce mentioned that, I remember your story of how you found the special cancer virus volumes 8 and 9, special cancer virus reports 8 and 9, right there in Chapel Hill Library, didn't you?
That day is a day I will remember for my whole life, I'll tell you. That was an amazing experience.
Yeah, you were pretty excited. I thought it was interesting that, you know, a few years later that I found out that George de Bournchild was tied to Henry Kissinger and George Merck, who you really cite in your books.
Oh, interesting. Give us a little background.
We're going to have to take a break here. So if you, Bruce, you want to stay on for a minute, you can.
Sure.
We're going to have to break away from our...
That's okay.
Well, actually, we don't have to break away, because I suddenly realized we don't have any listeners up in the Great Northwest now, except on the Internet, so we'll just let this music run itself out. Okay, fine. Did you have a point you wanted to make, Bruce?
I went to a church here in L.A., St. Monica's, where I was an altar boy 40 years ago, and things have sure changed since I was an altar boy.
They had the bongo drums, or?
No, they were shaking hands and holding hands and clapping and everything, and I wondered if SARS and the flu and any other epidemic comes along, what are Christians going to do when it comes to, like, spreading germs at church?
Okay, anyway, do you have any thoughts of that at all?
Oh, boy, yeah, you open up a can of worms for me. That's a real hot button for me. You know, what really kills me is that, you know, here the Messiah, you know, the blessed Messiah Yeshua, his real name, essentially created a healing ministry that's today called Christianity. And the fundamental statement, the restatement over and over again that he told everyone was when they thanked him for healing them, he said, it is not me. It is you and your faith and trust that has healed you. And faith and trust in who? The great creator. And I look at the vast majority of the Christian community in gross deception today. First thing that they think of when they get a little sniffle or cold or flu or anything on their body, they right away, without faith and trust, rush to the medical deities to pop magic pills to cure every ill. You know, if we simply did exactly what the Messiah said, which is lay your hands on people with faith and trust, and you can move mountains if you have as little faith and trust as a mustard seed has. And the fact of the matter is that that's what I'm experiencing out here, and why, one of the reasons why I'm in Hawaii right now is because I'm gathered together with a group of like-minded, totally loving individuals that see the common vision of coming out of her, my people, lest he be infected by her plagues, come out of the Babylonian medical deity-directed healthcare system and a globalist agenda and form healthy families, healthy communities, sovereign thinking, and basically self-sufficient in every way, including the healing arts and sciences, which really, it's so simple. Ultimately, the spirit, and also something else the Messiah said to the Christian community, he said, you will do more than what I have done, he told his disciples, and he's to pass on the word to the rest of the community. Well, you know, if this is the end times, as all of the prophets have agreed it is, with the weather changes and the great plague striking and the great deception of all the nations with all the financiers doing their number, ultimately.
Don't forget those tornadoes, unbelievable tornadoes.
Exactly.
I've never seen any tornadoes like we've seen this last few days on television.
Yeah, that's exactly. All the direct, it's bio-spiritual warfare. I cover that in the book, Death in the Air. It's the HARP project. It's the associated manipulations of the electromagnetic frequencies, because that's end times bio-spiritual warfare. But the point is that if we all agree that these are the end times, then when will the Messiah's words be true? If not now, when are we going to do more than what he has done? And I'm, you know, really blessed to be here in among a bunch of people who feel we want to fill those voids. We want to have a full, complete power and upliftment from the Holy Spirit of divine love and protection and prevention and be able to bless people with that divine healing. And it's happening. For people who have the ears to hear this truth and the heart wide enough open to receive the blessing without fear, and you can't go into fear, and that's why the beast in its system in the media is consistently reinforcing fear, fear, fear. You have got to come out of her. You've got to shut that television off. You've got to turn off the news, and you've got to turn on to the truth, which is the great creator's blessing. And it's free. And it's powerful. And all we have to do, literally, is with faith and trust, lay our hands on the sick, and they will heal by faith and trust in the creator. And so that's the big message. We've got to stop this insanity.
Okay, fine. Anything else you want to say, Bruce?
Where are you at in Hawaii, Leonard?
We're developing a community. As a matter of fact, I just...
Big Island or Little Island?
The Big Island, on the easternmost part of the Big Island. We just...
Pahoa or Kapoho?
Yeah, Pahoa area.
Okay,
Pahoa
great.
Area.
Okay,
and we just acquired today...
Stephen Dragon lives there.
What's that?
My good friend Stephen Dragon lives on the most eastern part in the Lock community in Kapoho. And I lived there for three months in 2001, and it was one of the greatest experiences that I had in swimming with the sea turtles and everything.
That's right. That's what we have here, brother. That's exactly right.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Bruce.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, it sounds like you're having an exciting time over there.
Oh, it's a wonderful blessing for me. Honestly, I'm privileged and just totally blessed. And you know, it's not that I'm stopping. I feel like I needed to do this. I gave up my radio program, Stan. I last December, and I got it because I got from not only in my own heart and my own mind the need to withdraw and to do a spiritual retreat, but I also got it directly from a couple of Christian friends that said within seconds of me deciding, "Well, you got to check out Isaiah 26:17 through 21, which basically said, you know, you've been screaming into the wind like a pregnant woman trying to give birth in your labor pains, but your frights, your screams have been for naught. You have not brought salvation on the planet. So go into your room, lock the doors behind you, and commune with the Creator, because the Creator's got it handled. You don't have to stress yourself out. The Creator's got it handled. So basically the process for me over the last several months has been finding that place within myself that is the most pure and honest in every way. And, you know, to some extent I feel like Diogenes, you know, looking for the one honest man out there, because to a great extent a lot of us are kidding ourselves in many ways. And, you know, we could say, oh, I'll be there at a quarter after 12, and you don't show up till a quarter of 1, and you have a great excuse. Well, you know, where's the honesty and the integrity of the spoken word in that type of behavior, if it's consistent, if it's chronic? So the bottom line for me is, you know, I want to purify myself at this time. It's not only going to make me healthier, and that's the big key secret to immunity. The biggest, most important thing is a spiritual uplifting desire for service, serving other human beings in a meaningful way, and carrying that electromagnetic frequency vibration from the heavenly throne to uplift every aspect of your body. I'm so excited about the new research in DNA that I've been doing too, Stan. We'll have to do a show just on that. It is so incredible what researchers around the world have now discovered about how the DNA is actually a spiritual receiver and transmitter, and they have now proven every aspect of it and how it regulates the entire body. Ultimately, who we are as physical beings, the physical is simply a crystallization of an electromagnetic frequency. That's why the devil doers have utilized not only the electromagnetic frequency transmitting devices, not only in Alaska, but in the satellite technology that we went over in the book Death in the Air, but also for manipulating populations. You know, the psychotronic warfare, the frequency, all of this DNA research is ultimately the biggest suppressed news is that the DNA is not primarily a protein synthesis blueprint or map. It is a electromagnetic receiver and transmitter that ultimately is a complete spiritual antenna to the greatest source of all, the King of the Universe, and that we're constantly being uplifted. And that, if you've got that understanding, and you do some simple things, you follow the Levitical laws for good diet, good nutrition, lots of love, belonging, you don't have to worry about SARS or anything else, because it can't stand the vibration of the Creator that's flowing in your humble vessel, you know, your temple of the Creator.
Well,
your body.
There's a lot of things that we don't understand, but there, I mean, one of them, I think, is these electromagnetic situations that you allude to, and certainly we are electromagnetic beings, people as well as spiritual beings, and perhaps there's a relationship. We're going to be back in just a minute with Dr. Len Horowitz. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. And or 464-8295. That's 464-8295. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dr. Len Horowitz, and of course we're talking about, we're talking about all sorts of things, but we've started out talking about the SARS epidemic, and then of course we begin to get into how they're conditioning the minds of the American people. Oh my goodness, if there's a problem, you've got to go to the doctor, you've got to get this shot, because that's how we're going to take care of you, we're going to protect you. We're here from the government, and we're here to help. One of the most interesting things is most of the healthcare people didn't believe that when they tried to give them the smallpox vaccine. The people just wouldn't take it. And now they're going to go back and regroup, try to figure out how they can begin to get people fearful enough that they'll do what they're told to do. Now, we do have legislation being enacted in every state in the union at one level or another. And that, of course, is called the Model Emergency Health Powers Act, or the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. Here in California, it has mandatory vaccination. Well, what about the fact that we don't believe in it? Oh, you don't have that right. Herd immunity, we have to be able to vaccinate you. How do we know we can trust the government on the vaccines? They lied to us about the original polio vaccine because it had a cancer-producing virus in it. And then, of course, when they changed monkeys, then they gave us the monkey viruses. And then, of course, we know that they had mercury in the virus in the vaccines, and they poisoned the minds of so many of our children. And they knew the mercury was there, and they knew it was toxic. And they're even lying about having removed it. They haven't removed it. And we really cannot trust the people in positions of power because they have an agenda. And of course, they have a specific agenda. And if you read what they say, they really want to remove the majority of the people on the earth because there are just too many people. Or as Jacques Cousteau had said, writing in the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. And I don't think most people can honestly believe that. If I hadn't seen it in writing, I would find it hard to believe. Or reading the writing, and so much of this will be covered in my next newsletter. You need to get it. Then you need to copy it. You need to help us to get the information out across America. And Len, I know how you feel. You know, you've been working so hard for so many years. And as you say, it almost sometimes seems like we're just shouting into the wind. But the conclusion I came to a long time ago is I'm not going to save the world. My job is just to do the best I can, and of course, in the final analysis, the battle is the Lord's.
Absolutely.
So I think that you deserve a rest and a time to get away and perhaps collect your thoughts and draw closer to the Lord, because it's so easy to get so exhausted knowing what you know and, of course, trying to get this out, and the majority of the people out there really cannot believe that there could be anything as evil as people who would create diseases and create, epidemics and plagues to kill off large parts of the population. But that's because they've never met Thomas Malthus or Bertrand Russell or these other great philosophers. You know, one of the things I thought of the other day when I saw an article in the one of the news magazines that the gorillas in Africa are dying off. They're dying off of Ebola. And apparently Ebola is into the gorilla population now and just decimating it. Well, if Ebola had been in the wilds all this time, it would have killed the gorillas a long time ago. This has been, I believe, recently introduced, or relatively recently introduced, into the gorilla population. And, you know, I learned so much from your book, Emerging Viruses, about the Marburg virus, and, of course, which is just another variation of this whole Ebola. Would you want to talk a little bit about that for our listeners? Because I think it's so fascinating to realize that the first cases of this disease occurred in laboratory monkeys.
Sure, Stan. I just want to give you a heads up to, like, you triggered me to think about this part of the gross deception with SARS. Tomorrow, look forward to the Washington Post doing a slam dunk on me and doing it on all the people who have developed natural SARS formulas in the herbal arena or in the botanical arena. And I was very, very blessed to work with Dr. Joseph Puleo on the book Healing Codes for the Biological Apocalypse. Well, I met with Joey a couple, about 6-8 weeks ago, just after I came back from Toronto. And actually, it was a little less than that. And he gave me the formula that he had successfully used to treat patients with SARS-like symptoms. And I then did some further research and realized that there had been a scientific study that had been done already in University of British Columbia by 7 esteemed botanists led by the Professor Emeritus Neil Towers, who I'd heard of his great work. And he had tested bovine coronavirus with 100 different natural plants and herbs that were said to be, you know, the best from the native populations in medicine. And he found that there were two plants that completely inhibited the cell death associated with coronavirus infections. And both of them are all over the Northwest. One is Rosa nutcana, better known as rose hips. The other is called Amelencia alnifolia, better known as the serviceberry bushes or the Saskatoon trees. And so what I did was I developed a formula with Dr. Paleo's formula, and so we've put together a website called cureforsars.com. SARS.net, cureforsars.net. You can go on the website. You can check out all about this combination. Well, at any rate, I understand today the Food and Drug Administration, the federal authorities, have issued warnings to everybody that, like I did, like Dr. Paleo did, created a natural formula for SARS. And so the Associated Press called me up. Tomorrow they're doing a story, and they asked me, of course, when they interview you on something like this, what they're trying to do is weasel you into a corner so that you'll say something stupid, because they're really looking for some way to get you one way or another. And so, you know, basically I handled it as best I could, but look for that coming out tomorrow. The mainstream propaganda tomorrow is going to tell you that there's a bunch of charlatans out here creating natural cures for SARS, taking advantage of poor, frightened people. And my response, my last statement to the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post reporter, was, you know, I wish that the FDA would do the job that the public taxpayer money is actually doing, telling them to do. Far more important than catching a couple, perhaps, bogus charlatans would be to take care of the third leading cause of death in the United States, which is iatrogenesis, physician-induced illness, and drug side effects. That would be a good service to humanity. So, and anyway, that's you can look forward to that. Now on to Ebola. You want to go to Ebola?
Well, let's go to Ebola, because that is a rather frightening disease as far as its mortality is concerned, but very, very strange is the way it appeared. The only case, you know, the first case was over there in Marburg in laboratory animals. The only cases we have ever had in America were in laboratory animals here in the United States, and I think that was the basis of the hot zone, wasn't it?
Actually, the basis of the hot zone by Richard Preston, New York Times bestseller for 2.5 years, was a propaganda ploy paid for by the Rockefeller Alfred P. Sloan Consortium. The Sloan Cancer Kettering Memorial actually paid Richard Preston $20,000 to produce that, what became a bestseller, as a complete spin off of what the reality is. In fact, the author alleged that these types of viruses were spontaneously mutating in bat guano at the bottom of some deep, dark cave in the northwest Uganda region called the Kitum Cave. K-I-T-C-U-M, I believe it is. In fact, that's a metaphor for the United States Army's sixth top biological weapons contracting lab called Litton Bionetics. They ran this same company, and if you know Litton Industries, major military weapons contractor. You talked about Henry Kissinger earlier, that devil doer. Boy, I'll tell you, he's the 666 guy as far as I'm concerned. And ultimately, the position that he held under the Nixon administration as National Security Advisor, the alternate for that post was the president of Litton Industries, Roy Ash, who today is one of the leading Republican fundraisers for the National Republican Party. And so good old boy network, you know, and that they had this medical laboratory called Litton Bionetics that operated in northwest Uganda, and their monkey colonies were in southeast Uganda. And they supplied all of the world's leading vaccine developers, cancer researchers, and biological weapons industrialists with all the monkeys, monkey cell lines, monkey viruses, cancer viruses. And if you go to the SARS website, the www.sarsscam.com, the big one that I think is certainly available, because I reprinted and I posted for you to see with your own eyes, the recombination in that laboratory, Litton Bionetics Lab, of acute lymphocytic leukemia virus with influenza and para-influenza virus. In other words, you think SARS is bad. How would you like to have an airborne cancer virus that would spread cancer by sneezing? And acute lymphocytic leukemia, if you're diagnosed with that anywhere in the United States, you're given typically 6 to 8 weeks to live. And so this is what they created. This is the lunacy, the insanity of these people and their capabilities of having that be a type of a big one. And so when you talk about Marburg and Ebola, basically what I was able to do in the book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, I have a chapter dedicated to this whole part of the study called Marburg, Ebola, and chilling propaganda in the hot zone, whereby I actually tracked the origin of the Marburg virus, which is the mother of Ebola, was Marburg. And just to give you some background on that, the Marburg virus broke out in three vaccine production facilities virtually simultaneously in 1967. Belgrade, Yugoslavia, Frankfurt, Germany, and Marburg, where it got its name. And it was caused by a shipment of approximately 500 monkeys that Richard Preston actually mentioned, but he didn't mention who had shipped it. It was Litton Bionetics, and I reprinted their contract in the book Emerging Viruses. And your friend that called in earlier, that was the day that I found those contracts, that he saw me at University of North Carolina Davis Public Library. And so the bottom line is that the mother of Ebola, Marburg, the mother of Marburg was called rhabdovirus simian. And how do I know that? Well, because that same man, Dr. Cy Coulter, the chief in charge of diagnosing what viruses were outbreaking from the labs, the, quote, emerging viruses, end quote, that's Cy Coulter's term for it, that he said that the mother of the Marburg virus was the rhabdovirus simian, which, again, if you look at the Litton Bionetics list, their menu of the mutant viruses and the infectious agents that they had in their lab in 1970 and 71 when that was printed, you see right in there, rhabdovirus simian recombined with a variety of other types of agents. Now, what is rhabdovirus simian? It is a rabies type of virus that originally ran in rodents. But way already back in the 1960s and 1970s, they were changing the species by injecting a rodent virus into monkeys to get it to jump species. It's real simple to do. All you have to do is inject one virus from one species into the bloodstream of a second species, and because the protein nature is modifiable on the outside membrane coat of the viruses, they adapt. And then when they adapt, they are able to enter the cells. And like so many viruses do, they enter the nuclei of the cell and wreak havoc with the genetics. And so that's what they were doing in these studies, and we document that meticulously in the book Emerging Viruses. And subsequently, we know the mother of Ebola, Marburg, the mother of Marburg, rhabdovirus simian, and the mother of that, and the father of that. You can thank Henry Kissinger, and you can thank Litton Bionetics' Roy Ash, because it was Kissinger who in 1969, as good friends with Roy Ash, also serving in the Nixon White House, told his good colleague, hey, we're going to create some biological weapons here for population reduction, because I've got to write National Security Memorandum 200 that calls for a massive one-third of the populations of Africa to be depleted and elsewhere in third-world countries, my friend Roy Ash, said Henry Kissinger. He says, I'm going to give you the contract. We're looking at, in fact, how we know this happened was because Walter Isaacson, who's managing editor of Newsweek today, wrote a book, a biography of Kissinger, wherein Kissinger requested from Admiral Zumwalt of the Navy. The Navy has been at the forefront of biological weapons research and development for America since Eric Traub came over from Hitler's group at the end of World War II. But ultimately, Kissinger told Admiral Zumwalt to prepare an analysis on America's biological weapons capabilities so that he could see where we were, and that he selected the options from there. That was 1969.
Was that Admiral Zumwalt?
Yeah. Admiral Zumwalt, yeah.
Right.
And what does that mean in German? To the world. Zumwalt. Zumwalt, okay? That's to the world. And so these guys were after the world in their glory. Well, Kissinger actually then selected the option, according to Isaacson. And what actually happened within a month of him selecting the option was you had the congressional record have that classified section that Zaire's Miles found and gave to Robert Strecker, which was the appropriations request for 1970 for the development of immune system ravaging microbes for germ warfare that were descriptively and functionally identical to HIV/AIDS. This was 15 years before it was allegedly discovered by Dr. Robert Gallo, the appropriations request was made in Congress and never declassified. It was found by accident as Zaire's Miles was ruffling through the shelf of his military office. He found it, copied it, sent it to Robert Strecker, and Strecker made it famous.
Okay. Where is that? Is that posted any place?
Oh, yeah. I posted that everywhere.
Where is it posted? I'd love to see that.
It's the first one is in the book, the beginning of the book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. It starts with that because that initiated my next three-year investigation after the Kimberly Brigalis case. That's what I wrote up in the Emerging Viruses.
What's the title of that?
It's called Appropriations Request, 1970 Appropriations Request for $10 million for AIDS-like virus. It's right at the beginning. I think it's one of the first figures of the book, Emerging Viruses. And I also reprinted it in the latest book, Death in the Air, Globalism, Terrorism, and Toxic Warfare, in the actual photocopied documents.
So this was after Dr. MacArthur had actually requested that from the House Appropriations Committee.
That was the exact testimony given by MacArthur in this appropriations hearing. And you see in there where it says, if you go into the congressional record, you will find that section is classified. And it says in the congressional record that more information is available, but it's classified. And this portion of what Zaire's Miles discovered and gave to Robert Strecker is that portion, or at least a large part of it. An extraordinary, revealing section that deals with biological agents for germ warfare.
Well, now, you mean the testimony of Dr. MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee was the entire thing was classified?
No, the section, you can read it as it exists right now, but there's a section that the congressional record says is going to be made classified
okay.
and not let out.
Okay.
And that section contains that what we've reprinted, originally found by Zaire's Miles. And it opens up the whole can of worms concerning the man-made military applications and order for the development of AIDS-like viruses. Here's what it says, quote, over the next 5 to 10 years, it will be possible to produce a new infective microorganism that could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing microorganism. And most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunologic and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious diseases, end quote. They go on to say that this type of research is highly controversial, highly risky, and that's why they kept it classified.
In fact, some people think it might be another very a means of mass killing.
That's right.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Question?
Just a request.
Yeah.
That this discussion should include a little bit about the Merck laboratories and their hepatitis B vaccine that introduced HIV into the gay population.
Population, right.
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Yeah. If you want to have the latest... you still there with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I must have another incoming call that we'll pass on for another 10 minutes. Right, Stan?
Right.
Go to about 6 months ago, originofaids.com. Go to www.originofaids.com, and you will get the most advanced science all around the world, the most respected authorities in dealing with the origin of AIDS through the potentially transmission of polio vaccines. They met in London in the year 2000, and they concluded, they drew the conclusion that they couldn't conclude because they couldn't definitively prove that the polio vaccine had been produced in chimpanzee tissues. And so what they concluded, however, was that no doubt it was a man-made event, no doubt that it was either needle stick injuries or vaccines that induced it. But what Dr. Gerald Myers said, who's the director of Los Alamos Laboratories DNA sequencing, an analyst, and the top expert in the world in DNA sequencing, he said, we did not have one single AIDS outbreak in Africa in around 1975. We had 10 simultaneous emergences of 10 different strains. And the only thing that could explain that, he said at this esteemed international conference, is some man-made extraordinary event that involved chimpanzees in a colony that were used for some purpose, and he alluded to medical and no vaccination. Now, that is the thesis that you are advancing, that the caller has advanced. And that's the thesis that I advanced in the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. And I've got the only documented proof in the world that the chimpanzees were used to produce the 1974 experimental hepatitis B vaccine produced by the Merck Pharmaceutical Company in the chimpanzees that were shipped to them from Africa to New York by the same company, Litton Bionetics. And, of course, Henry Kissinger dropped out of his directorship of the 9/11 investigation. Why? Because he didn't want to reveal his corporate contacts. To this very day, he's still on the board of directors, the board of advisors, the chief advisors of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company, whose president, George W. Merck, was none other than America's biological weapons industry director at the exact time that he received the lion's share of the Nazi war chest at the end of World War II. So that brings Kissinger tied into General Bowling and brought Eric Traub in Project Paperclip, the Nazi exfiltration program for the biological weapons aces that they brought to America, worked for the Navy. Kissinger was involved in that whole network to begin with. Merck Pharmaceutical Company was heavily involved. The president of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company ran America's biological weapons industry entire program. And subsequently now, I find it highly suspicious and highly incriminating that they don't want to tell you. Nobody wants to look at the fact that we've published the documentation that proves that that specific vaccine produced by these horrific, I wouldn't even call them human beings. They're aliens as far as I'm concerned. That they actually had this vaccine prepared, gave it to gay men in New York City, blacks in Central Africa, and simultaneously in 1974 and 5, the 200,000 human doses on record. Government documents, scientific reports, meticulously documented and referenced. That's what brought AIDS to the world.
There were more cities than New York, right? San Francisco, L.A., and one other.
Yeah, but that was a secondary. And when you read the book Emerging Viruses, you'll find that those were the more that was a distraction. In fact, the study, the thesis that you and I both raise here, the hepatitis B vaccines linked to AIDS, that was brought to the CDC's attention early on, like around 1985, and the Merck Pharmaceutical Company and Abbott Laboratory Group had funded anonymous authors. Get this, whenever do the scientists not want to put their names on a scientific paper? It was such a disgrace what they did that they didn't even feel obliged to put their names on it. There were several anonymous authors along with CDC authors that said that these men were tested, the gay men in Denver, in San Francisco, and in Los Angeles were tested, and that there was no apparent association between having received the hepatitis B vaccine and HIV positivity or AIDS, where, in fact, none of those people were given the vaccine. The vaccines were given primarily to the guys in New York City. The investigators principally were from New York. And so they left out that complete population because at that point in time, you already had 60% of those gay men in New York City who had received the hepatitis B vaccine. They were HIV positive or had AIDS or had died. So that it was highly incriminating. So they literally, that's the bogus science that we deal with today.
Okay.
How many thousand gays do you suspect were given HIV-tainted vaccines?
There were in Shmulo's study there were 1,863.
That was New York?
That was in the New York trial, but that was the latter part of the trial. That was 1978, and people like Dr. Alan Cantwell, who's been doing excellent work, he doesn't embrace what I've dug up. I mean, he loves it. He supports my work, but he doesn't really make a big deal of it, and I don't understand why. Because, I mean, he's bringing to people's attention to the 1978 hepatitis B vaccine trial and saying that that's what initiated. Well, that can't be, because there were already cases in 76. You've got to go to 74. And what was being done in 74 is what I dug up. And again, by the grace of the Creator, now I'm not going to take any credit for it. Honestly, I've just been a humble servant following the direction. The bottom line is that there were 200,000 human doses prepared in 1974 for immediate administration, and the pilot studies that led to the large-scale trial were conducted starting in 1974. And how do we know that for sure? Because we've got the contracts.
And who was the contract with?
Merck Pharmaceutical Company led the contract.
All right, fine. We're just about out of time. Thanks very much, Mike. I'm just going to quickly go to Bruce and then to Cecil. Bruce, we're just about out of time. Quick question.
Yeah. The last time I asked the question, the commercial came on.
Yeah, I know, but we're just about out of time, and I got one more call.
Well, I wanted to ask Leonard what he thought the odds were that George DeMornchel would be friends with George Merck and Henry Kissinger, and the website that he gave isn't working, so I wanted to get the clear website.
Which website is that?
SARSandScam.com.
SARSScam.com.
Tried that.
SARS, S-A-R-S-S-C-A-M, all one word.
SARSScam.
SARSScam.com. And then go to, for the cure for SARS, go.
Yeah, that's working.
For highly effective treatment, go to www.cureforsars.net.
Yeah, that's working. Okay, can you say what the odds would be that Henry Kissinger and George Merck would both be friends with Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend, George DeMornchel?
It's pretty small. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Statistically significant.
Right. Okay, let's go to Cecil. Hi, Cecil. Quick question. We're just about out of time.
How you doing, Dr. Stanley?
Doing fine.
All right. I just want to make a statement, and I want to thank you both for bringing this attention to people, and you are starting to connect the dots. And I know you have to go, but what's very important is there's a history here, and it leads back to Nazi Germany.
Absolutely.
That's so scary. That is so scary.
Yeah, not only that, but they've targeted certain racial groups, and that's unconscionable. Hey, we're out of time. God bless you. Thanks so much for listening. And, Len, I want to thank you so much for taking the time this evening to be with us.
My pleasure, Stan. Give out your number so people can get the books and make themselves educated.
Okay, and 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-MORE. Emerging viruses, death in the air. You need to get this information. God bless you. Thanks so much.
Love you, Stan. Be blessed, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders, to pray for our boys overseas. But please remember to pray for and to support Radio Liberty. And so until Monday when we'll be back, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Thank you so much, Steve.